African Republic on Sunday voted in presidential and legislative elections being held under a cloud of violence as the government, international partners, and United Nations peacekeepers sought to hold off a rebel advance. Militias hostile to the incumbent president, who is seeking a second term, have stepped up attacks since the Constitutional Court this month rejected several candidates, including former President Francois Bozize. Voters in Niger went to the polls Sunday in an election that is expected to lead to the West African nation's first transfer of power between two democratically elected presidents. A smooth handover could be a bright spot for a country blighted by widespread poverty and Islamist violence that has killed hundreds of civilians and soldiers in the last year alone. Turkey's parliament passed a law on Sunday that would ramp up oversight of foundations and associations and, according to rights groups, including Amnesty International, risks limiting the freedoms of civil society organizations. The law allows the Interior Minister to replace members of organizations who are being investigated for terrorism charges, while the Interior Ministry can also apply to courts to halt the group's activities under the new law. South Korea said on Sunday it will extend social distancing measures introduced to try to curb the spread of the novel coronavirus pandemic for another 6 days to January 3rd, even as it continues to report near record numbers of new cases each day. For the run-up to Christmas and New Year holidays, the government banned gatherings of more than four people in Greater Seoul and closed down ski resorts and other tourist spots. This is VOA News. As the year end approaches, we take a look back now at some of the stories that made headlines this year. On January 11th, less than 2 weeks after it discovers a cluster of pneumonia cases of unknown cause, Beijing announces its first death from an illness which will become known as COVID-19. By March, a pandemic has been declared, and a month later, half of humanity is in lockdown as governments scramble to halt its spread. Massive state aid programs are rolled out to save jobs as the International Monetary Fund predicts recession, with the global economy shrinking by 4.4%. In November, drug companies announced positive results for several vaccines as a second wave of cases lashes the planet. Within a month, the first shots are being given, but by Christmas, some 1.7 million people are dead, with the U.S. being the worst hit. Belarus strongman President Alexander Lukashenko's disputed victory in August 9th elections sparks 4 months of anti-government protests centered on his main rival, political novice Svetlana Tikhanovskaya. Opposition leaders are jailed or driven into exile. 2020 sees the U.S.-China relations nosedive, with Trump calling COVID-19 the China virus and saying Beijing is responsible for a mass worldwide killing. They also clash over the repression of a Uyghur minority in the Chinese region of Xinjiang, as well as the national security law imposed on Hong Kong. Deeply divided Americans vote in record numbers in the November presidential election between outgoing Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Joe Biden. After days of nail-biting, Biden takes the White House. Trump alleges fraud and doesn't concede defeat. Heavy fighting for the Armenian-populated region of Nagorno-Karabakh, which broke away from Azerbaijan after a war in the 1990s, goes on for 45 days. Several thousand die before a Kremlin-brokered peace deal on November 9th, with Armenians losing swaths of territory to Azerbaijani forces. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed orders a military response to attacks on federal army camps in the dissident northern Tigray region. The Tigray People's Liberation Front, which has dominated Ethiopian politics for nearly three decades, denies responsibility and says the reported attacks are a pretext for an invasion. Federal forces take the region on November 28th. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time magazine, Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The United States Congress passed a pandemic relief package worth almost $1 trillion U.S. dollars that will deliver long-sought assistance to individuals and businesses. The wide-ranging bill still fell short of the Democrats' demands for funding, and President-elect Biden is already signaling his intention to provide a third round of assistance in the early days of his administration. Over 40 countries have imposed travel bans on people arriving from Britain after the government announced last week that it had detected a new, more contagious strain of the coronavirus. A more contagious strain was also detected in South Africa. Meanwhile, the European Union gave official approval for the coronavirus vaccine developed by BioNTech and Pfizer, while the United States began distributing a second COVID-19 vaccine developed by U.S. drug maker Moderna. U.S. lawmakers, including President-elect Biden, Vice President Mike Pence, and the leadership in the House of Representatives and Senate have already received vaccinations. A massive hack of U.S. government agencies and private companies is being called unprecedented in its size and scope, with security experts pointing to Russia as the culprit. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Attorney General William Barr said Russia appears to be responsible, and leaders in both political parties called for a strong response from the White House. However, President Donald Trump disputed the severity of the breach and Russia as the responsible party. And in a tumultuous start to the final month of his administration, President Trump continued his attempts to undermine and reverse the results of the 2020 election, with Trump loyalists suggesting that he impose martial law to enforce new elections in swing states that he lost despite the Electoral College declaring Biden the winner. Finally, Trump announced his latest round of presidential pardons, which included two men convicted of lying to Special Prosecutor Robert S. Mueller and four government contractors convicted in connection with the killing of Iraqi citizens. Panelists, welcome. And it's just a completely packed show today, so we'll try to get right to it. I wanted to start with the COVID relief package. Congress passed a $900 billion pandemic relief package that will deliver long-sought cash to Americans. It's a massive document, some 5,600 pages, my sources say, is one of the largest, if not the largest, bill in writing that they've ever seen come through from the Congress. It has some essential items, such as direct payments and extended unemployment benefits. It also excludes some items that both parties had fought for. Molly, I'll start with you. What are the most critical items that are included, and what was left out that each side wanted?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, the biggest headline in this bill is the money for ordinary Americans to help take the edge off all of the disruptions and suffering that COVID has caused in the economy. So at first, the lawmakers were not talking about further direct payments. Instead, they were simply going to extend the enhanced unemployment insurance that was provided earlier in the year. But there was a sort of confluence of interesting political coalitions where some populist Republicans such as Josh Hawley and left-wing Democrats such as Bernie Sanders were together advocating for these direct payments to be part of the bill. And the White House also was said to have wanted that. There is an extension of that enhanced unemployment insurance, not the $600 per week that was in earlier packages, but about $300 per week. Some other provisions targeted toward COVID, money for things like vaccines and vaccine distribution, some more small business aid, forgivable loans to small businesses to help them stay afloat since so many have had to close. And then there's some stuff that's unrelated or tangentially related to COVID, yeah, as tends to happen in these big sort of Christmas tree bills that Congress passed. And this was all done as a package with the annual spending bill that also needed to be passed to keep the government open. As you mentioned, there were some things that both sides wanted and had to give up. For Republicans, it was the idea of liability protections for businesses. taxes, which was something that the Senate leader, Mitch McConnell, had called a red line earlier, but eventually gave up in negotiations. And for Democrats, it was aid to state and local governments whose revenues have seen a big hit from COVID at the same time as they are providing so many public services to help people get through it. But state and local governments will get funding in some other areas from other parts of the bill, such as funding for schools that is in this bill separately. So it's a big bill, not as big as some wanted, but it does represent a bipartisan compromise. And everything seemed fine until at the 11th hour, the president decided to cannonball into the pool and declare that he was not happy with this negotiation that he really had not been a significant part of.
Abdur-Rahim, Republicans and Democrats are blaming each other for a delay in this bill. I think very few people, if any, thought it would be this long before relief was distributed by Congress to the ordinary American during this pandemic. They're blaming each other. Are they both right? Are both sides to blame?
I think they are. It has to be said for people, obviously, who don't know how big of a deal Christmas is in the United States. Traditionally, Christmas is a big deal, even in normal times. But there's absolutely nothing normal about the times we're going through now with COVID-19 and possibly its mutant variant of it, and the kind of suffering that COVID-19 has imposed on Americans, both in terms of sickness, lives, economic difficulty. And you have members of Congress who've been bickering about this for months through the suffering of a lot of Americans, a lot of American families, a lot of American businesses. I find it extraordinary that $600, the checks that Americans are supposed to receive, $600 could be a lot of money for a lot of families. But I still find it, you know, extraordinary that both parties have been bickering about this. And now, after they reached this bill, there's talk about, well, you know, the Republicans never told us that the president would be okay with $2,000 as the amount of the check, as the Democrats are now saying. $600 is a lot of money. $2,000 could be even a bigger help, obviously. But 2 days before Christmas, it's still not sure where the whole situation is headed. Will Americans receive $600 or $2,000 or nothing at all? We don't know at this point, with the president having taken the line that he's taken. We don't know if he's going to veto. We don't know if he vetoed, what complexity overriding the veto would involve. Both Republicans and Democrats passed this with comfortable majorities in both houses. But there's no guarantee that the comfort around overriding the veto would still be there if it came to it.
Molly, you mentioned the president weighing into these negotiations. He has been noticeably absent through the entire process. And now it seems as though he's putting out a fire with a can of gasoline here. So what does he hope to achieve by these proposals on this legislation, making the statement that the bill is a disgrace and the bill is outrageous and unsuitable? Does he really expect to get the changes that he's asking for? Or is this yet another political ploy to, in essence, drum up support for his desire to stay in office?
You know, it's always a risky proposition to try to discern Donald Trump's motivations, but it really does appear to be nothing deeper than a desire for attention. You know, as you said, the president has been disengaged with this process, not just this negotiation, but the entire process of COVID relief, you know, starting when the two parties in Congress started working on emergency legislation back in February. From time to time, he would wade into this debate with conflicting messages, sometimes saying he was for something, sometimes saying he was against it, sometimes urging the parties to come together and negotiate without at all specifying what he wanted to see in the bill, and then sometimes declaring, you know, that he was walking away from the table. So he hasn't at all been a constructive presence in these talks, and he's been pretty disengaged, particularly since the election, from anything having to do with COVID. So it is quite true that neither party had any idea. And the White House itself, and, you know, the president's negotiator on this bill was the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin. He did not know that the president was going to put out this statement, or that the president was displeased with the place that the negotiators ended up. It was a very difficult negotiation, very polarized and partisan Congress. They were finally able to get to this point and get something that could pass both houses. And at that point, Trump seems to have realized that this was all done without him being a part of the negotiations. And he seems to have seized on some sort of misleading right-wing tweets having to do with the amount of foreign aid, not in the relief package, but in the overall spending bill, to declare that there was, you know, waste and bad spending in the bill at the same time as he's calling for more spending for the checks for Americans. So it will be a really interesting test now that Trump is on his way out of office. Do Republicans, are they still afraid of him in the same way? Will they still do his bidding simply because he says so, even when they clearly would like to go home and celebrate Christmas with their families instead?
Indeed. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Molly Ball, National Political Correspondent for Time Magazine. Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's Regional Director for the Americas. And our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. The COVID-19 update, it was a mixed bag of news regarding the pandemic as Germany, Belgium, France, and Canada were among the 40 countries that imposed travel bans on people arriving from Britain after the British government announced that last week it had detected a new, more contagious strain of the virus. The World Health Organization says it is also studying variants of the coronavirus that was found in Britain and South Africa, adding that there is no evidence that they are deadlier or more severe than the more common strains. And again, the best thing that people can do is to work to suppress transmission through mask wearing, social distancing, and hand washing. I'll start with you, Abdulrahim. What are doctors saying about the new strains of the coronavirus? And does this discovery of the new strain represent a new threat and even a setback in the battle against the pandemic?
The doctors are saying, with the initial panic that came with the news that the variant was discovered in the UK and that many countries have basically stopped flying to and from the UK, there came a silver lining with specialists like Dr. Fauci saying that they do not necessarily believe that this could be a worse form of the virus than the COVID-19. I think us here in the United States, if one can talk of a silver lining, I don't know to what extent it is a silver lining, but to the extent that people were gearing up for Christmas and that Dr. Fauci, the administration of Donald Trump, the team of President-elect Joe Biden have all been calling for people to be extra cautious. All the talk about locking down some parts of the economy in various parts of the United States, I guess that has cushioned the panic that would otherwise have come with the news of this new variant of COVID-19. To the United States. So the country would have called for extra caution no matter what. The fact that the news has coincided with Christmas, I guess, is the silver lining, because at least psychologically, it helps contain the fear and the panic.
Molly, a famous novel begins, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." And that seems to be an apt description of what we get when pandemic news these days, when we see record numbers of positive cases being recorded, record numbers of deaths, hospitals being strained to the limit. And at the same time, we see, again, a second vaccine being approved and being distributed within the United States. I want to ask you sort of about the politics of the distribution of the vaccine, because we see that the CDC recommends that first responders, more vulnerable populations are vaccinated first. But we also see at the same time, President-elect Biden, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, Senate Leader McConnell, and other electeds jump to the head of the line to be vaccinated. We also see coronavirus deniers like Marco Rubio and Lindsey Graham getting early vaccinations. What's the importance of the opticals of this? Is it reasonable and correct for our elected officials to jump to the head of the line? And is there a backlash against those getting vaccinated who have been deniers and in some cases spreaders of the virus itself?
I don't know that any of those, I would call those politicians deniers. I mean, they certainly acknowledge the existence and severity of the coronavirus, even if they may have disagreed with aspects of, you know, the experts' recommendations for the response. But look, there is, as you know, there's an obvious tension here, because on the one hand, the supply of the vaccine is limited and governments have to decide how to prioritize different populations as they get those limited doses out to the public. On the other hand, there's a lot of skepticism of vaccines, both the vaccines in general from this, you know, anti-scientific, anti-vaccination movement that has spread so vastly in the United States in recent years and has done so much damage. And also that this specific vaccine, I think there's skepticism around, partly because there's been so much disinformation and misinformation around COVID overall, and partly because the Trump administration in the United States and other governments around the world have not necessarily inspired great public trust with the way that they have both handled the COVID-19 response and put out information about it. So these elected officials, as they presented, they're not trying to get something that other people can't have in order to sort of hog it for themselves. They're trying to demonstrate to people that this is safe. They're trying to provide assurances to Americans who may be worried about whether it's okay to get this vaccine, that this is something they should trust and it is something they should want to do. So they're trying to set a good example and say, if your turn comes up on the list, please do get the vaccine, because everybody who's eligible needs to get it as soon as possible in order for society to be able to further reopen and return to normal.
And health professionals have also said that even with getting a vaccine, people should maintain social distancing and also engage in mask wearing. So we'll see if those politicians who have taken the vaccine will also follow up on points 2 and 3 and be consistent and send positive messages in that way. Let's move on to the U.S. hacking issue, a massive hack of U.S. systems that raised alarms across the government and the private sector. This from an NBC News report. U.S. officials are deeply concerned about a massive and ongoing cyber attack targeting large companies and U.S. agencies, including the Treasury and Commerce Department. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency called the attack a grave risk to national security. Secretary Pompeo and William Barr have said Russia appears to be responsible. Russia, of course, denies any involvement. And President Trump seems to be of a completely different mind about what happened and who done it. Abdur-Rahim, what do we know about who was affected? And there is a general consensus that Russia is responsible for this. Am I right?
There is. Members of Congress, many of them agree that it was Russia. Lots of private companies involved do believe that it was Russia. Mike Pompeo said in an interview that he believed it was Russia behind the cyber attack, although in the same interview, it has to be said, he did say that he thinks China is an existential threat to the United States. But obviously, President Trump captured the headlines. He captured everybody's attention when he said that it's not Russia. It may be China who is behind the attack. That obviously has raised a lot of old questions, the old skeletons about why is the president always trying to, as his critics say, defend Russia. So there's a quasi consensus that it was Russia in Washington, that it was Russia behind the attack. But we don't know that for sure. There were members of Congress who even went so far as to say that what happened was a declaration of war. But we heard from Joe Biden, the president-elect, he didn't go so far as to call it a declaration of war. We've seen some catchy editorials in like the one in the Washington Post by David Ignatius saying also that he doesn't think that it was a declaration of war. It was part of espionage that usually goes on in the world, except that this is a massive scale. And I found it interesting that he compared the United States in terms of the internet to what Lebanon or Belgium are, as small countries where basically other peoples fight their battles. Now, David Ignatius says that the United States is the internet territory, so to speak, where a lot of international powers are now fighting their battles. Obviously, what happens in the United States doesn't stay in the United States. I mean, the United States has a lot of cyber relations with a lot of its allies around the world, and many of its allies use software and infrastructure basically made in the U.S. and shared with them by the U.S. So there's a lot of concern around the world as well.
Indeed. Molly, some are calling this a hack, while others, like Democratic Senator Dick Durbin, are calling it an attack. And I believe he used the description of the attack being akin to Pearl Harbor. An attack demands a response. And my question to you is that response likely to come from the Trump administration during these last days of that administration, or is that response going to have to wait for the incoming Biden administration?
I think it's clear that it's going to fall to the next administration to straighten out the very tangled morass of Russia policy in the United States. And it's going to be a really interesting area to see how President-elect Biden decides to handle Russia. You know, back when Biden was vice president under President Obama, a lot of Republicans were critical of the administration for not being harder on Russia and not dealing more forcefully with Vladimir Putin. Fast forward to the Trump administration, that's not a very common Republican criticism because, as Abdul-Rahim was saying, the president has been so reluctant to criticize Russia and Putin in particular, for reasons that appear, again, to be personal sort of ego-related motivations on Trump's part, having to do with his sensitivities over the Russian interference in the 2016 election, which every American intelligence agency has corroborated, and the only person in the government who appears not to believe it is the president. As you said, it does matter how we look at these kinds of maneuvers. It is both an attack, it's a cyber attack, and it is a hack. That's the way these things are done. But because the president appears so invested in wishing away these kinds of attacks, it's clear that the next administration is going to have to take on both the logistical response in terms of how to protect the American government from these kinds of attacks, figure out how the attackers were able to penetrate these systems and try to shore them up, and then the diplomatic response, whatever types of sanctions or other potential responses the new administration is going to try to levy on Russia in retaliation for this. And it's going to be a very delicate and difficult area of American foreign policy that's going to be, I think, on the front burner of the many, many diplomatic crises that the next president faces.
I want to finish with sort of get some broad thoughts from you. You had meetings in the White House discussed imposing martial law, something we've never seen in a modern White House. We have the White House considering installing fringe elements as special counsels to investigate the election that was called by professionals the safest and most secure in American history. And then there was a slew of pardons that include a veritable rogues gallery of cronies, corrupt politicians, and war criminals. Molly, let's start with this martial law idea. Michael Flynn, who was former national security advisor and now a convicted perjurer, convicted and pardoned, I should say, by President Trump, and others were in the White House asking the president to declare martial law. This from reports. How far in your reporting has the discussion gone? Is it still being considered?
Yes and no. I mean, it's an idea that the president likes because it's being dangled in front of him by these basically irresponsible charlatans who want him to believe that he continue to stay in power when that is absolutely not the case. These types of anti-democratic maneuvers are really a threat to our democratic system, and they're being enabled by these sort of fringe elements. As you mentioned, you know, even people like Attorney General Bill Barr, who have shown themselves willing to do the president's bidding in a lot of ways that trouble outside observers, even they have sought to get as far away from these kinds of suggestions as possible. And you hear a lot of alarm from the people who are still left in the administration at the lengths to which the president appears willing to take this. I don't think there's any chance that any of this actually happens, but just the fact that the president is indulging, you know, the insane conspiracy theories like those being promulgated by the attorney Sidney Powell. It just can't be emphasized enough that the things that they're saying about problems with the election aren't true. They are feeding the president lies, and he is eagerly lapping them up because he wants to believe that there's some chance that he can somehow overturn the legitimate result of this free and fair election.
Abdul-Rahim, I want to finish with you on the point that Molly just made.
Quickly, let me say, it seems to me that whatever he does now, whatever he says, is not going to change the outcome that Joe Biden will become the next president of the United States. But like Molly said, although they're not likely to pan out in anything practical for him or for the rest of the United States, these are very significant developments, whether in the specific context of U.S. democracy or in the specific, in the general context of what the U.S. means to the rest of the world. There are obviously jokes around places like the Middle East that, you know, President Trump has been so buddy-buddy with dictators and military regimes in some parts of the world like the Middle East that he's becoming a bird of a feather. People following this, whether you're talking about the issue of declaring martial law or politicizing the amnesty for the people that he's amnestied now, as I said, dictators and military regimes around the world, they just gone to town over. So they're basically saying, look, if the United States of America can do this, we can do it too.
There's so much more to talk about on all of these topics, but unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to our panelists, Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, and Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.
From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. On this year-end edition of the program, we bring you highlights from 2020. Hello again, I'm Carol Castillo. To say that 2020 was an eventful year would be an understatement. Throughout the year, the world has been fighting the deadly scourge of the COVID-19 pandemic. In early March, the coronavirus pandemic dominated the headlines. Declared a global pandemic by the World Health Organization on March 11, COVID-19 continues to ravage lives, overwhelm hospitals, and destabilize economies. My colleague Rick Pantaleo and VOA health reporter Carol Pearson spoke with former director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Thomas Frieden, currently president and CEO of the group Resolve to Save Lives. He shared his thoughts regarding the public health response to the emerging pandemic.
This is unprecedented. Other than influenza, which spread each year, we've never seen a new virus emerge and then spread around the world. It has already been more disruptive than any infectious disease event since the 1918-1919 influenza pandemic. So the most disruptive infectious disease event in more than 100 years. One of the things that I wish we would do more, and I hope that we'll do more very quickly, is to learn more about how the virus spreads, whether it spreads from children and asymptomatic people, what works best to protect healthcare workers so that we can target our interventions and be as effective as possible in our response. That means that public health departments need to be in the lead on the response, figuring out what works, communicating that effectively with the public, and doing investigations so that we can learn more and do more to protect people. There are things that we can do right now. Every one of us needs to wash our hands more, cover our cough, not infect others if we get sick, and stop shaking hands for a while. People who are medically vulnerable, older people with underlying health conditions, where this is spreading in the community, really need to isolate themselves from others to protect themselves.
Dr. Frieden, can you please take us back to the start of this COVID-19 crisis? How did the virus develop and then initially spread?
The best available theory now is that this emerged in China around November of last year and then spread ultimately from a bat host through some intermediate animal host, possibly or probably through what's called a wet market or a market where exotic animals are sold for food. This is the same way the SARS virus spread 17 years earlier from China. No one's certain, but what is certain is that this is unprecedented. Never before has there been a brand new virus. Influenza does this, but other than influenza, a brand new virus that has emerged in one part of the world and become a pandemic all over the world.
At year's end, the development of several vaccines against the virus brought hope that the end of the pandemic may be near. In May, my colleague Kim Lewis and I spoke with Professor Peniel Joseph, founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas, about his recently published book, The Sword and the Shield, The Revolutionary Lives of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. Joseph tells us that despite their different backgrounds and tactics, these two activists for racial justice had much more in common than is normally thought. In this excerpt, Joseph asserts that Malcolm's concept of radical Black dignity and King's notion of radical Black citizenship overlap.
King's notion of what I call radical Black citizenship over time converges with Malcolm's notion of what I call radical Black dignity. And Malcolm is really a representative of the third world and this idea of this titanic struggle between the global North and global South. And in the context of the post-war period, the way in which billions of people indigenously around the world were asserting their freedom. You think about the 1955 Bandung Afro-Asian Conference, the non-alignment movement, anti-colonial struggles in Africa, but really the larger third world and the Caribbean. Malcolm is representing that group, including African-Americans in the United States, and making this argument for radical Black dignity, by which he means the end to racial violence and racial oppression that's happening globally. Dr. King is talking about something similar, but with different points of emphasis. King talks about radical Black citizenship. King is preaching a philosophy of a beloved community, a community free of racial oppression, free of economic injustice. But he says that citizenship is not just the freedom from racial segregation and Jim Crow, but citizenship is a guaranteed living wage. It's decent housing. It's racially integrated public schools and neighborhoods. It's the end of poverty and also the end of war. That's what he argues. And over time, even as they start out with a lot of tension, they come to see that you really need both. You need radical dignity and radical citizenship globally for social change to happen. And when we watch the evolution of their careers, really by 1963, you're going to see some real major overlap between the two of them.
Kim, how about a question from you?
Sure. Dr. Joseph, when you were researching the childhoods of both Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr., what did you find in their childhoods that were some potential factors that made them the men that they grew up to be?
They have very much contrasting childhoods. Of course, Malcolm X, his father is murdered by white supremacists in Lansing, Michigan in 1931 when Malcolm Little is only 6 years old. His mother is institutionalized in a psychiatric facility for really most of Malcolm's entire life. So his family is fractured, and his family had been Black nationalists. They had been Pan-Africanists. They had been followers of Marcus Garvey, who was the Jamaican Pan-Africanist, founder of the Universal Negro Improvement Association. So Malcolm has a harsh childhood. He grows up in both Omaha, Nebraska, and Lansing, Michigan. But by the time he's 15, he leaves foster care. He's already well over 6 feet. He's going to grow into 6'3". He goes to see his half-sister, Ella Mae Collins, in Boston, and he lives in the Roxbury section of Boston. So racial trauma scars, absolutely scars Malcolm X. Martin Luther King Jr. has a different upbringing completely. He is raised along Sweet Auburn Avenue, really a son and a prince of the Black upper middle class. His father, Martin Luther King Sr., is the head pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, one of the most influential Black churches in the United States, in Atlanta. And his mother is coming from generations of African-Americans who have been elites. His father was a sharecropper and the son of a sharecropper, but on his mom's side, he's an elite. And what we see with Dr. King is that he gets the best education. He goes to Morehouse College at the age of 15, but both of them face racism.
Kim Lewis of our Current Affairs Unit, along with VOA TV reporter and a host of VOA's Our Voices program, Haiti Adams Fitzpatrick, spoke with Dr. Davina Dorgana, statistician with the Walk Free Foundation's Global Slavery Index. The trio talked about a new report that explored the need to reframe how modern slavery is an extension of gender inequality. Dr. Dorgana explained what is meant by modern-day slavery and trafficking, since there is often a misconception around what it means to be a victim of slavery today.
There is quite a bit of continuity between the traditional abolitionist movement of 1700s, 1800s that you mentioned, specifically when slavery was a legal construct. This was when slavery was something that was legally permitted. And from a legal perspective, it was governed, it was an accepted part of a lot of world economies, right? This was a critical element of the transatlantic slave trade, for example, was built on the backbone of the exploitation of people, right? This was a lot of our colonial history. But what's interesting is that actually modern slavery was abolished in Mauritania only in 1981. So in some countries around the world, these slavery and slavery-like practices had been not just practiced in reality, even without a legal foundation, but they were also, in some cases, like in Mauritania, practiced quite legally, and the institution was protected that way. There's one major difference that we like to highlight between historical slavery and modern day slavery, and that is exactly what we're addressing here. That historically, the United States, for example, there was a lot of movement around changing laws related to slavery and slave ownership, particularly in the US South. But what's interesting is today, the version of modern slavery that we address is no longer permitted by any legal construct in a country, let's say. These are situations where modern slavery, where people are still exploited for labor, they're subject to a lot of very similar conditions, and they are even further hidden from public view. So whereas historical slaves would be visible and seen in a lot of these situations, there wasn't much of an incentive to hide them because they were protected by legal institutions at the time. Now we're talking about modern slaves in a context where that situation is not openly permitted. And so they become much, much harder to find, which means that our work, really looking at the statistics and the prevalence of modern slavery, becomes a lot more challenging because we have to really fight cultural conventions and the natural proclivity of traffickers and other criminals to hide these behaviors from public view.
You're listening to the best of Press Conference USA 2020 on The Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel, reminding you that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Let's get back to today's Press Conference USA, featuring highlights of the program over the past year. I sat down to talk with Ali Soufan, a former FBI supervisory agent, currently founder and CEO of the Soufan Group, an international strategic consulting firm based in New York City. We discussed the recently released unredacted version of his best-selling book, The Black Banners, How Torture Derailed the War on Terror After 9/11. When the book was published almost a decade ago, large portions were redacted for what were claimed to be reasons of national security. But after a long fight mounted by Ali and his supporters, the Central Intelligence Agency finally lifted those redactions. He told me what was revealed from the previously redacted material and the significance of the declassification.
Well, basically, anything that shows that torture did not work was redacted. There are lines where you will see, for example, the sentence starts and after sleep deprivation, and you see a lot of black lines, a lot of redactions. And you'll think, okay, you know, after sleep deprivation, that terror suspect said something or divulged national security threats. And now you can see that basically what was redacted, that after sleep deprivation, not a shred of information was given. That gives you an idea about the level of trying to cover up the alleged efficacy of torture or the false information about the efficacy of torture. You will see now how we get information that resulted in the disruption of the so-called dirty bomb or the plots against apartment buildings in the United States or the plots against Los Angeles or the alleged plot against the Brooklyn Bridge. A lot of these things we heard about from high-level people in the Bush administration, to include the president themselves. And then now you will see exactly how we got the information. And you will see that all this information was obtained even before enhanced interrogation techniques and waterboarding were applied. So now the American public can see that the torture torture methods did not work, and they can actually know that what they are reading is the truth, because everything that was redacted in the Black Banners redacted on national security grounds. So when you redact somebody's account on national security ground, in a way you admit that it is the truth. I think, unfortunately, for those people who deceived the American public and they wanted to continue to deceive the American public, they never thought that we will fight for 9 years to make these redactions go away. And now, finally, the American public will hear the truth. And I have to take this opportunity to thank the leadership of the CIA for this act of institutional transparency that they allowed the truth to be out there for the American public and, frankly, the world to know.
Ali, I wonder, do you think that the FBI, particularly the CIA, rather, has taken these lessons to heart?
I hope so. I think, you know, remember, many of the people who were involved in this are not there anymore. They retired and they're not part of the government. I think there is a new leadership. There are new folks in the U.S. government who basically saw what happened before, and now they can see the truth of what happened before. And hopefully we won't repeat it. And that is the reason that I fought for all these years, because we needed transparency. Transparency is extremely important to have conversations based on truth.
In October, just a couple of weeks before the 2020 presidential election between U.S. President Donald J. Trump and his Democratic challenger, former Vice President Joe Biden, I returned to Newcastle, my hometown in Lawrence County, Pennsylvania, an important battleground state. While there, I interviewed Republican activist Richard Flannery and chairman of the Democratic Party of Lawrence County, Paul Stefano. Both were featured on Press Conference USA this past July. I thought it would be insightful to get their takes on the factors that were driving Pennsylvanians to the polls and which candidate was likely to benefit. Republican Richard Flannery shared his opinions on the issues that are important to voters in Lawrence County and if President Trump would again win in the November 3rd election.
I don't know about whether Biden has improved in Lawrence County or not, but regardless whether he's improved or not, in my view, President Trump is going to take Lawrence County again. The support for him here is as strong as ever. There's a lot of leadership in our Republican Party who are so much behind the president and the events that are going on. In my view, President Trump's going to take Lawrence County again.
What about other parts of the state, Richard Flannery? We're seeing state polls that show that Joe Biden is actually leading Mr. Trump by at least 5 to 6 to 7 percentage points, which is a bit different than in 2016. How do you see the statewide election?
I think it's become problematic for President Trump that Joe Biden has picked up across the state. I can't pinpoint where or by how much, but from what I see right now, unless these polls are inaccurate, and very often they are, I would suggest that as of today, Joe Biden would win Pennsylvania.
What is the sense that you get from the voters? You talked about the economy, COVID pandemic. What about the health care? The last time we were at these microphones, you did say to me that that's an important issue.
It is an important issue. I will say this, that maybe it's just that because I'm Republican, I think the Democrats are misstating and are out of context on what they think President Trump would do if he was reelected. I do not believe for a minute that President Trump or Republicans in the Congress would do away with pre-existing conditions. To me, that would be outrageous.
Paul Stefano, chairman of the Lawrence County, Pennsylvania Democratic Party, shared how he viewed the political temperature of this Western Pennsylvanian community from his party's perspective, and if Joe Biden had a chance of winning there.
We had a voter registration edge for 4 decades, and we lost it this spring.
That is the Democrats.
Yes, the Democratic Party. You know, we lost this edge, but we have a lot of excitement for our candidate. And what I think happened with the voter registration edge, a lot of people that had for years voted Republican now just became Republican. That's not good news for us, but it might just be because there were a number of Western Pennsylvania counties where this happened, where, you know, those counties may have performed in a more favorable way to Republicans than the registration would have you believe. In the last 4 years, those counties have had more Republican voters. So we believe voters that had voted Republican now just became Republican. We lost voters statewide as a party. However, we had more new registrations join the Democratic Party. So we believe people that have been voting Republican for a while, probably since the era of Reagan, have now formally become Republican in these years of the Trump presidency. We outvoted Republicans in the primary election this year, which made us feel good because we said, well, that might be an indication of excitement on our side. And then in the course of time, over the last, it's been 4 months, we've had a lot of interest in the candidate. We have a lot of volunteers. And what we're hoping, we lost this county by 11,000 votes 4 years ago, which based on our registration should not have happened. Our goal is to shave that margin. We do not believe we can turn that margin around. We want to. We don't believe that.
You don't believe the Democrats can win in Lawrence County, Pennsylvania?
No.
At the end of October, I spoke with two distinguished female members of Congress who decided against running for re-election in 2020. My first guest was Congresswoman Nita Lowey, a Democrat who has represented New York's 17th Congressional District, an area just north of New York City, for more than 30 years. Ms. Lowey is the outgoing chairwoman of the powerful Appropriations Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives. Congresswoman Lowey talked about her work with the Appropriations Committee and why the word powerful is always used to describe it.
It's very clear that if you're chair of appropriations, you're in charge of all the money, $1.4 trillion, and give or take a little bit here and there. And we make the decisions as to how we spend the money. I work with my colleagues. We have very, very committed, outstanding members on this committee. And when it comes to the funding, we make these decisions. And I do think how you spend your money is really an understanding of our values. So I work very hard. And we make, I think, decisions that make life better for people all across the country and internationally around the world.
As chairwoman of the committee, what types of programs and priorities have you championed?
As you know, the Appropriations Committee has 12 subcommittees. I serve on the Foreign Ops Appropriation Committee. But of course, I have a voice in every one of the subcommittees. But I'll talk about that for a minute because I know it's important to you. I have been a strong advocate for international education for women and girls. This has been critical as I've traveled to many countries, and you see how important it is to give our girls the tools so that they can stand taller and they can be their own people. I remember another incident which was very critical. We are in charge of the research budget at the National Institutes of Health, and I made sure that we were promoting gender parity because at that time, even the lab rats were male. I often talk about that because we had to make sure that funding at the NIH provided investment in women's health, women's research, women's funding.
My second guest for the program was Susan Brooks, a Republican who is the outgoing representative of Indiana's 5th Congressional District. Congresswoman Brooks serves on the Energy and Commerce Committee and the House Select Committee on the Modernization of Congress. She talked about her accomplishments throughout her 10 years in the lower chamber of Congress.
Members, I think, typically focus on the legislation, but I don't think we can ever underestimate the important work we do on behalf of constituents who have had issues with federal government, whether those are veterans dealing with the Veterans Administration or constituents dealing with Social Security or the IRS. We work on foreign adoption issues. Those are probably the most meaningful types of work that we do. But when it comes to legislation, I partnered with Anna Eshoo of California, and we got the Pandemic All Hazard Preparedness Act. So believe it or not, I've been involved in biodefense issues and pandemic issues long before this pandemic struck. We got that bill reauthorized with increased funding. back in June of 2019. I also worked on mental health with law enforcement issues. And now with law enforcement really being under siege, trying to make sure that law enforcement not only have a better understanding of mental health, but that they also receive mental health assistance. Worked on the opioid crisis, something that really gripped the country and has the addictions issues. So very involved in opioid and mental health legislation. And then I also chaired the House Ethics Committee during the Me Too movement, when a lot of members had been accused of sexual harassment in the workplace or their staffs. And that was a very difficult time for the country. But we also were able to work with other members to get some of that legislation passed as to how those matters are handled in the House. To wrap up my time in Congress, I'm very proud to be on a significant bipartisan committee, the Select Committee on the Modernization of Congress. And that is to try to find ways. We came up with 97 recommendations to improve and modernize Congress. So I'm really proud to be going out with that work just finishing up.
On November 3rd, Americans went to the polls to elect the next president of the United States. All 435 members of the House of Representatives and about one-third of the Senate. Given the unprecedented number of mail-in ballots due to the coronavirus pandemic, media outlets weren't able to project former Vice President Joe Biden as the winner of the election until 4 days later. On December 14, the Electoral College, which determines the winner, certified that former Vice President Joe Biden earned 306 Electoral College votes to President Trump's 232, guaranteeing that Mr. Biden would be sworn in on January 20, 2021, as the 46th president of the United States. Biden also garnered at least 7 million more popular votes than Mr. Trump. Nonetheless, President Trump continued to reject the results, falsely arguing that widespread fraud invalidated the election, even though court after court, including the U.S. Supreme Court, rejected his claims of voter fraud and his bid to overturn the election. Mr. Trump refused to concede to President-elect Joe Biden. Elaine Carmack, founding director of the Center for Effective Public Management and senior fellow in the Governance Studies program at the Brookings Institution, explained the implications of the 2020 election results.
Well, I think it's two things. Obviously, Democrats like myself are very, very happy that the Trump era has come to an end. We're pleased with the breadth of Joe Biden's win. He's got a significant Electoral College victory and a significant victory in the popular vote. But we were kind of artificially buoyed by the early polls. And I think a lot of Democrats, myself included, expected that there would be more change in the down ballot races, that there would be a pickup in the House of Representatives. Instead, there was a loss. And we even dreamed of getting the United States Senate, which could still happen, but it's really, really, really close. And it depends on two Senate races in Georgia. So we're happy, we're relieved, but our expectations were higher. And I think some of our expectations have been dashed.
What about the turnout? I mean, this was a high voter turnout in the midst of the pandemic.
It was a very highly mobilized electorate on both sides. I mean, President Trump's voters really turned out, and they turned out on Election Day just exactly as he had asked them to do. Joe Biden's voters turned out in mail ballots. Lots and lots of ballots came in early. Every state broke records for the number of mail-in ballots. And that was, of course, a function of the pandemic and people not wanting to go out to polling places, to places where they'd be with strangers. And so this was a huge turnout on both sides. And the numbers aren't really in yet, but we may have the highest turnout in a century in American politics as a percentage of eligible voters.
What do you make now of President Trump's refusal to recognize the results?
Well, it's, again, one of the kind of mysterious things that this president has done. It's not surprising. This president has defied conventional wisdom from the very beginning. He marches to his own drummer. He doesn't seem to have any interest in respecting the norms of democracy that other presidents have had. He views conspiracy theories all over the place. place. And he is particularly skeptical about elections. So in 2016, when he was winning Republican primaries, he was totally skeptical and saying the system was rigged, which people were sort of scratching their heads and saying, but you're winning. In 2016, in the fall, when he was in the general election, he persisted in saying that the system was rigged and that he would not concede if Hillary Clinton won the election. Again, it was like with no evidence, just sowing mistrust all over the place in order to protect himself and his ego should he lose. For Donald Trump, this is a very difficult thing to do. So a lot of what we're seeing is him just playing out something that he needs to play out. And a lot of people going along with him, understanding that, yeah, he needs to do this and eventually it will stop.
And that's Press Conference USA's look back at 2020. Thanks so much to Rick Pantaleo for producing this year-end edition of the program. I'm Carol Castiel. From all of us at the Current Affairs Programming Desk at VOA, here's wishing you all a very happy and healthy new year. Thanks for listening, and please join us again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Berman. Europe launched